I understand.
The Health and Human Services Policy and Oversight Committee will come to order for our first meeting of the year. And we do have a quorum. So I thought we could start just, why don't we, I was going to skip introductions, but I think we probably should do them quickly here. So why don't we, I'm Paul Thiessen from Minneapolis and represent Richfield as well, District 63A. Maria?
I'm Maria Root, I represent 42A, which is Southern Minnetonka and Northern Eden Prairie. I'm glad to be back on this committee.
I'm Erin Murphy, and I am from St. Paul 64A.
Carolyn Lane, Columbia Heights, Fridley, and Little St. Anthony.
Mr. Chair, Tim Kelly from Red Wing 28A.
Cy Powell, 65A.
Tom Huntley, 7A, which is Eastern Duluth.
Paul Torkelson, 21B, Olive Brown, part of Watonwan and part of Redwood County.
Tim Norton, representing the north half of Rochester.
Hi, Jim Abler from Anoka in the city of Ramsey, and I'm the minority lead, but I want to announce that Steve Gottwalt has agreed to be the assistant minority lead. There's so much topic stuff here, so when he shows up, at least that way you know. So, thanks.
Tina Liebling, I'm the vice chair of the committee, and I represent part of Rochester. The most of what Kim Norton doesn't represent, I represent.
Resident of Mac? Okay. All right, well, that's her, I think. And President of Loffler just walked in here. And then the staff, can you guys just introduce yourselves quickly?
I'm Emily Cleveland with House Research, and I cover the Health Department programs and issues.
I'm Danielle Lemire from House Research, and I cover some human services issues, the income assistance programs, and the long-term care for elderly and disabled.
I'm Dan Pollack. I'm DFL House Research.
I'm Kate Prusak. I'm the committee administrator.
Ursula Griscock, committee legislative assistant.
I'm Lynn Ace with House Research. I handle human services, child welfare, chemical dependency, mental health, and state-operated services.
Randy Chen with House Research. Cover state health care programs, health reform, and nursing home reimbursement.
Linda Boudreau, Republican Research.
Emily Anton, Sergeant
Arms
Base
for
Health. All right, well, thank you.
Yes.
I did, yes, go ahead. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Tara Mack from Napa Valley and Burnsville, District 37.
All right, well, thank you, everybody. For coming. We're going to have a lot of work to do on this committee. It's a fairly active committee typically. A lot of bills get referred here. And we'll be talking a little bit about how we want to handle all that as we go along. But I did want to just go over a couple of things. There's some procedures in the packet which are largely similar to what you'd see in other committees and which we had last year. Please let either Kate or Ursula know about if you're going to be missing a committee so we can plan ahead for that. And get you excused. We are going to use a 24-hour rule for amendments and handouts, as far as possible and practical. Really, if we could limit it to technical stuff on kind of amendments on that day, it would, I think, make things go a lot more smoothly. And we're going to make a commitment on our end to get out agendas and bills and all of that in it well in advance so people have the opportunity to get those amendments out. Representative Abler.
And just to that point, just that's a reasonable rule, but maybe if there's a way to, if you can get some amendments to us, so we can know how to react to them. So it's hard to make an amendment the way you don't even know it is. So.
No, and
maybe those rules can be flexible for reacting to an amendment.
Amendments to amendments, I think, are a different issue, but we'll try to get as much information out as far in advance as possible. And for authors, that goes for delete all amendments or substantive amendments to your bills, too. I mean, I think the approach we're going to take is if you have a major amendment that doesn't show up until the day of the hearing, we're just going to put the bill off so we can find another time to do it. So, as far as we can do that. we'll get hearing requests to Kate, and I don't see Tom here, Representative Emmer here yet, but we're going to try to enforce the no laptop and electronic cell phone rule as far as possible. So please, it helps in a lot of ways. And then one other thing that I want to announce, and this is for everybody out in the audience too, it will be significant. We got an extra hour and a half of time this year in our committee schedule, and so starting a week from today, next Tuesday, we're not going to start committee till 3:15. So we'll just have an hour hearing on Tuesdays so that the caucuses have a chance to meet, have a half an hour to meet just as, on their own to kind of plan ahead, and I think that'll actually help move things along more readily in committee as well. So the schedule, and we'll post this whenever we post our hearings, but the schedule will generally be 3:15 to 4:15 on Tuesdays, and then the typical hour and a half meetings on Wednesdays and Thursdays. So I guess that's it for any other questions on procedures or how we'll proceed here? That starts the week from today, yeah, next Tuesday. Okay. Well, then the first thing up today, I'm going to, I guess, move this right on over to Representative Liebling.
So in your packets you have the bill for today, which is House File 42, and just so everybody knows, we will not be voting on this bill today, but we are going to move the bill so that we can adopt an author's amendment.
Madam Chair, I'd move House File 42 be recommended as passed.
Okay, so the bill is before the committee, and Representative Peason, would you like to move your amendment?
And I'll move the A1 amendment as well.
Okay, Representative Peason moves the is it the DE1?
The A1 amendment.
The A1.
Label, but
The A1. Representative Peason moves the A1 amendment. Those in favor of the motion to adopt the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. And now that we have the bill as the author would like it, I will call on Representative Peason to explain the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a bill that this is the amendment that everybody should have gotten emails from yesterday as well. It's in the same form as what you got yesterday. And what the what House File 42 does is it's an attempt to provide some relief to Minnesotans who are unemployed and in need of health care. And this is, I will say at the outset, a work in progress. One of the reasons we're not voting on this bill today is because there are quite a few policy questions that we need to resolve as to how to best accomplish this goal. And I hope that we can have a good discussion starting today, but kind of in the next week or so, to think through what those policy decisions are and what's the best way to achieve the goal. And my main goal here is to make this as unbureaucratic and automatic and simple as possible, so that we don't create a whole new structure around this program. You know, I think everybody understands that we're in the middle of a recession, a deep recession, and experiencing job losses in the country and in the state that we haven't seen in a long time, probably longer than any of our legislative careers here. We've lost $2.6 million jobs nationally in 2008, which is the most since World War II. And in Minnesota, our unemployment rate reached 6.4 in November, and as you know, those job losses are accelerating as we speak. In the last one, we just heard a number of more layoffs out in Hutchinson yesterday at Seagate Technologies. This job loss is reaching broadly and deeply. And I think that the situation of job loss becomes more dire than it might even appear in the service, because when a person in a family loses a job, very often that family also loses their health insurance. And it turns out, based on many studies, including a few studies that have recently come out, that most families can't afford to pay for the COBRA, which is really the option we have for families right now, and are making either a difficult decision to go without health care for their families, or their employment benefits are eaten up substantially by the cost of covering of purchasing health care in a different way. 25% or more of benefits. And in Minnesota, according to one study, for family coverage, nearly 70% of an unemployment benefit goes to cover the cost of an average health care, of an average COBRA payment. And so what House File 42 does is basically is designed to provide 6 months of Minnesota care coverage to individuals who apply for and are enrolled in unemployment, the unemployment program. It waives the four-month waiting period for those folks. It waives the asset limit, and it also waives the program's spousal income limits. And the reason that that decision was made, that it's designed that way, is, again, to make this program as efficient and automatic as possible for this very short-term period. It caps the length that you can stay on the program for the time you're on unemployment or up to 6 months and no longer. And in that period, you either have to apply to get on a public program or find another form of insurance for you or your family. So for that kind of very short-term emergency situation when someone becomes unemployed, the way that this bill is drafted, in my sense, is that we want to err on the side of making it easy, accessible, and unbureaucratic, as opposed to trying to target particular incomes, target particular people, which adds a lot more complexity and makes this program much more difficult to adopt and enroll people in. I think this bill is an important part of the work we're going to be doing in the legislature to take care of the thousands of families in this state who have recently lost their jobs and are going to lose their jobs in coming months. You know, we all know that when people don't have insurance, they forego necessary preventative care. They get often get sicker. Their chronic conditions deteriorate, which is one of our leading cost drivers. And we're, as a society, left in a much worse position than we would be if people had access to affordable health care. And not just access to it, but access to it in a continuous type of way. The other piece of this that's, I think, important and we can't lose sight of, and that's going to be true of our discussions all year, is that 1 in 8 Minnesotans work in the healthcare industry. And as people put off, we're already seeing this happening with layoffs in that industry, as people put off routine healthcare and delay treatment, local clinics and hospitals suffer, and those workers get laid off. And it weakens one of our state's largest economic engines. And I think that piece is really important as we think about this. There's a letter in your packets from a man in Rochester who was recently laid off, Dan Kirchner, and I encourage you to take a look at that. He wanted to come up but couldn't afford the trip up to the Capitol today. But the basic story is that he was recently laid off for the first time in his life as an RV master technician at the age of 51. And his wife, Debbie, lost her job as a teacher and is now a substitute teacher, but she doesn't get health care benefits with that job. The family has 3 grown children, 1 18 and the other in their 20s, who have been covered on Dan's employment, employer-based family plan. And now all 5 of them are without health insurance. Dan is receiving $114 a week in unemployment, but his COBRA payment is $1,700 a month for family coverage, which clearly is unaffordable if you do the math. It's a debt situation, actually. And so people are looking for an affordable health care option. What we proposed here is one option that could get immediate relief to families. We're going to have a number of testifiers to talk about unemployment, to talk about COBRA, that program, and to talk about a variety of ways. But again, my goal here is to really have a real discussion about this and come up with a solution that will help Minnesota families get them relief as quickly as possible and do it in a seamless and unbureaucratic way. I want to emphasize that goal is a little bit in tension, and I'll acknowledge that up front with some other values we have, which is trying to target money to those most in need. But I think in this time of economic crisis and in the situation we're facing right now, and because this is a very short-term piece of relief for Minnesota families, I think the tension should be resolved in favor of an efficient program, and that's how this is designed. So I look forward to working with everybody on the bill and for your ideas. And with that, I guess if we could, you want to take questions about the bill before we go to test fire.
Are there
research?
Questions first? Representative Amherst.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen,
I really appreciate the fact that somebody is trying to do something for all these families that are clearly struggling, and especially with health care. The question I have for you is just for the benefit of those of us who may not know, what specific benefits are available to somebody like, I think it's Mr. Kirshner, was that the name? What specific benefits would be available to him and his family under Minnesota Care?
Madam Chair and Representative Emmer, that's a good question. The way that this bill is written, it would be the benefit set that would be available to children and families, which is a fairly comprehensive benefit set. And quite honestly, that's another piece of this policy discussion that we should have, is what a benefit set should be with regard to this. But it would be, we have, you know, basically two benefit sets. This would not be with the $10,000 hospital cap.
Can you get, Madam Chair, Representative Teaching, can you give us an idea, generalizing, what would be the general parameters of the benefit set that would be available to somebody like Mr. Kirshner and his wife, Debbie?
Madam Chair and Representative Emmer, and again, it's fairly broad. So Minnesota Care would, I believe, and staff can help me out with this, but include dental coverage. It would include mental health services. It would include basic health care. I don't know if Randy or Mr. Chun, excuse me, has...
If I can help Mr. Chun, if you're the one who's going to answer it, rather than knowing the menu of items that might be touched upon, I'm interested to know in how much coverage, if you will. I mean, I know that's probably the wrong term for a public program, but how much do we allow for these folks when it comes to mental health coverage, when it comes to just routine checkups, emergency room visits? How much is available to them?
Mr. Chun.
Madam Chair, Representative Emmer, the benefit set would be similar to the MA benefit set. There are a number of benefit sets for Minnesota Care for families and children. It would be, I guess, close to the MA benefit set. So it would cover preventive care. It would cover all of your basic health care services. So I guess compared to maybe an average private sector policy, it would be, you know, a fairly comprehensive benefit set, or usually in most cases probably at least equal to that policy. In some cases, probably providing more services.
Follow-up, Representative Emmer.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Chun, could you get me a comparison as to what the benefit set would be as compared to any one of the plans that we might get in the private sector?
Mr. Representative, I can provide that.
Madam Chair, I've got a couple of follow-ups. Representative Thiessen, why 6 months?
Madam Chair and Representative Ever, because I think that's the typical amount of time to get unemployment benefits.
That's all it's based on.
Yeah.
All right. I'm wondering if you've looked at a, Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, have you looked at a private, a subsidy program, kind of a temporary or emergency subsidy program for the private market? So for people like Mr. Kirshner, if he's unemployed, creating based on need some type of voucher or subsidy payment to allow them to continue to remain in the private market?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have considered that, and that's another option that we can go to. But my concerns about that are a couple. First of all, if you did mention, you know, based on need, I think that adds in a whole level of complexity that I would like to avoid as far as possible with this, because then you're going to have applications and you're going to have to collect data about income, and that just slows the whole process down. So that's the first thing. But to your point about a subsidy, we could subsidize a COBRA plan. Again, I think that adds a lot more complexity to the program, because you're going to have to figure out what that person's COBRA plan is like, how that fits in with the benefits they're receiving and other income that they may have. It certainly is a possibility, but I, again, think that it's a much more difficult administratively to implement.
Okay. Madam Chair, one last one, and then I'll...
Representative Emmer.
I mean, and I do appreciate Representative Thiessen. We've had some of these discussions over the last couple of years, and we're going to hopefully have a lot more over the coming weeks. Have you talk about the administrative issues. And I think we could have that discussion for more than just even today's hearing. But I'm interested to know, have you done or had anyone do any analyses of what will happen if you pull these healthy lives out of the private market and put them into the government healthcare programs? I mean, have you looked at that to see if that will increase then the cost even more for private health insurance?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that there's actually a couple points that you raise, or that are raised in that question a little bit. The first thing I would say is that I don't necessarily think that everybody that goes on unemployment, I think there are, that everybody goes on unemployment will access this program. And we're doing it as it's drafted as a fee-for-service program. So we're not paying premiums for everybody that gets unemployment benefits, only people that access the care through this program. But I think there's some built-in disincentive for people to drop other coverage that they may have, including if their spouse has coverage and they're enrolled in a group plan. My sense is they're not going to drop that for 6 months and then have to re-enroll, and we can, you know, think through that. And so that's just an example of, I don't think this is going to be a situation where everybody that qualifies is going to drop into this plan. The second point you raised, I think, and I don't know if Representative Abler left or he's still here, but you know, on provider rates, and that's certainly something we need to talk through a bit more, because this would have, could arguably have an impact on that. But I have not done the analysis to say if it's going to drive up the cost of insurance by pulling these people out. I guess the other thing I would say is if you look at the numbers that we have in a variety of places, a large portion of these people aren't going to be in the insurance market one way or another because they're just not going to have health care. And so that will also have an effect on the point you're making about the pool of people in the healthy versus, you know, if they can leave the health, they can leave the commercial pool because they don't have health care or because they're in this public program. Most of these people are going to be leaving that public program that private commercial sector in any event, in the short term at least. And so I'm not sure that the point you raise, I haven't done the analysis, but I would think there's a lot of reasons to think that it's not going to have a huge impact on the millions of lives that are covered in our commercial program to have the number of people in our unemployment unemployment program leave the commercial market.
Well, and I appreciate that. I look forward to more discussion. I just suggest that maybe as we proceed, when you say that there are going to be incentives and you don't think that people are going to leave if they have incentive to stay with private, I think on a much broader scale, I think Hawaii's had an interesting experience over the past couple of years that we may want to look at for people who think that they were getting free insurance, and in fact it's caused major problems. And granted, that goes well beyond the unemployment scheme that we're talking about today, but I think we should draw from every resource and other people's experiences before we jump into something just based on what we think might happen.
And Madam Chair, I mean, I think that point is well taken, but the more important point is the last one, which is this is a limited context for these types of programs, and so I'm not sure that any broader program analysis really applies here. But a fair point, and we do need to look at that.
Okay, I've got the three people on the list. We've got Norton, then Gottwald, then Bunn. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We just came from an unemployment insurance talk in the last hearing I was in, and it says in 2008, 214,000 Minnesotans were paid unemployment. 70% of those are layoffs, and so they will automatically be eligible for what you're talking about, which I appreciate the thought put into that. My concern is for the 30% who are either fired or quit jobs and become unemployed, apply for unemployment, and as several constituents of mine have gone through, months of not knowing whether they're covered because they have almost a month to find out. If they're turned down, they appeal. That can take just quite some months down. And what's going to happen, I guess that's what I'm asking. Could you give some thought to what will happen to those people who are initially denied? Of those that do appeal, we know 40% of them are then approved. They may now be 2 months without health care, and how will we work with those folks who I know are going to be in real crisis, particularly without getting any of that unemployment benefit for several months as well. So I just raised that because I've had several constituents this summer who have been dealing with this issue, and I'm concerned about what might happen to them.
Representative Keeson.
I think it's a good thing to consider. I don't have an answer right now for that.
All right. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Thiessen, I appreciate you bringing this forward, too. I realize it's designed to address a need that is obviously going to expand. Representative Norton and I saw the same presentation today in the Biosciences and Workforce Development Committee showing projected dramatic increases in the number of unemployed over the next year in Minnesota, and obviously the eligibility for this program would expand with it. I've had an ongoing concern, and maybe I'm expressing a concern more than asking a question, but the idea of moving more and more people onto state programs that already underpay, as Representative Emmer pointed out, underpay providers, and the costs associated with that. We don't have a fiscal note yet on this, I understand, but we're looking for ways of meeting people's needs without putting more of them on state programs. And I know Representative Emmer asked this a little differently, but I keep thinking, are there private enrollment or private programs that we could be helping get people onto that they could either stay on or utilize once they're back into a job? Because people who are unemployed may be unemployed for a week, a month, 6 months, but they may be coming on and off very quickly, and it'd be nice to preserve private options for them rather than put them into another government program that really ends up cost-shifting a lot of the burden to the private sector.
Representative Thiessen.
And Madam Chair, again, I think that merits discussion. I just am not sure how we do that effectively. And I think the point you raise about we don't know how long people stay on these programs. I mean, one of the reasons about one of the possibility of getting someone in a private insurance program for a week or 2 weeks and then having them shift to another kind of program, another insurance policy because they get reemployed or they don't get the subsidy. In some senses, that may be more administratively difficult. I mean, one of the nice things about a fee-for-service type Minnesota Care program is that if they're enrolled, they show up at the doctor, that doctor's going to get paid. And then they shift to another kind of insurance, and then, you know, we can sort that out later. So in some sense, I think the short-term nature and unpredictable nature of unemployment, although I think we're seeing more and more long-term unemployment, may actually argue in favor of doing something like this in this particular context.
Okay, we have a couple more, and then we do have testifiers, too, so hopefully we can get through the questions a little bit quickly. Representative Bunt.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, just clarification on it today or in the future. I think it would be very helpful to me and possibly others thinking about this if you could break down kind of where the uninsured, you know, those who become unemployed go with regards to these decisions about health insurance. What percentage do continue with their COBRA, with their previous employer? What percentage shift to a spouse's health care plan, possibly at that point they may have been separate, and then they shift over and then pay the additional cost of that. What percentage go on to, you know, say the COBRA is too expensive and go out and buy on the private market a more catastrophic high deductible plan? My family did that at once to avoid the COBRA. And then there's also the issue of, well, I'll stop with that. First of all, clarifying that. And then secondly, on the comment side, it seems like in terms of disruption to their lives, that subsidy of their COBRA, where they continue with the health insurance and the system they've already been working in during this duration, is less disruptive for them, you know, than shifting to a new structure of some sort, possibly. So just if you could comment on the data issue.
Madam Chair, first of all, I think some of the testifiers will get at some of the questions that are being raised, like the data question, and there's materials in your packet that will probably answer some of those questions. On the COBRA thing, I mean, I think we do need to find out a little bit more. I actually think that it's going to cost more, arguably going to cost more to the state to subsidize a COBRA policy than not, than do it through Minnesota Care, but we can get some information about that. And again, if someone can come up with a proposal that would make it easier to identify who the check has to be written out for that subsidy from the state, you know, and figure out, okay, this person has insurance for this person, so we got to, you know, take this application, fill it out, find out who your insurance company is, find out what the address is, instead of just kind of an automatic enrollment in something, again, that's one of the tensions I think here, and I think you are creating a larger administrative infrastructure to do a direct subsidy. And we're going to get a report on affordability standard and how we do direct subsidies here in the next day or two, so we might get more light shed on that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Follow-up,
Representative
Trump. Okay. Representative
Hayden. Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, just to kind of follow up on, I'm trying to follow Mr. Kirshner's letter. It looks like in his instance that he is not going to be able to afford COBRA because he doesn't have enough income from unemployment insurance or whatever he's getting in order to provide health care for his family. So in the instance that he or someone in his family shows up at the hospital with a catastrophic injury or a serious medical problem, it would be the local government that would have to subsidize that. Is that right?
Well, if he showed up at Hennepin County, Madam Chair, Medical Center, yep, Hennepin County property taxes payers would pick up a lot of that cost, certainly. Or in Olmsted County, I suppose, if he shows up at Mayo or whoever it is. So, I mean, so there'd be government, the public would pick up that share. Certainly.
Right. So, if I may, Madam Chair, Representative, so on some level, this, you know, providing him with some fee-for-service insurance through kind of an automatic Minnesota Care allows us to be able to pay for some of that fee up front if he has an issue. But one way or the other, it looks like government would have to pay if Mr. Kirshner or someone in his family had a serious medical issue.
Madam
that
Chair,
he couldn't afford.
Representative Hayden, that I think is right. You know, unless there's another alternative to get him insured through some other mechanism.
Okay. All right. Well, if there, Representative Hayden, did you have a follow-up to that? Okay. If there are no other questions right now, let's move on to the testifiers, and then we'll probably have some more questions for them. I have John Gross. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Gross. I'm the Director of Healthcare Policy. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I was asked to briefly go through COBRA. There's a one-page front and back handout on that. Basically, COBRA has been around in Minnesota since 1976, federal law 1986. It's basically given the people the right when they lose their coverage to continue coverage. I think the most common incident is termination of employment. There's various continuation periods. I think what's important here is what we see so often is we call it sticker shock. People are employed. If you're fortunate to have a job where you have part of your health care costs subsidized by your employer, you're kind of sometimes not totally aware of what the heck the cost is. And when you have to now have to pay the entire cost, plus a 2% administrative cost, that can be kind of a shocker to a lot of people. And if you're unemployed, obviously, it could be real difficult to pay those premiums. I, as a state employee, I can go on COBRA. It will cost me $456.22 a month to continue coverage for myself. If I want to include my family, it's $1,341.64 a month. And the state of Minnesota's group health policy is a pretty rich policy. It's a policy that also has an older, sicker group, so the rates are kind of high. But each employer's premiums are dependent on the losses, the experience that group derived. Now, some groups, let's say you have a group of 21 young males, they're very, very healthy, none of them are married, that could be a low premium group. You might have another group like the state that's older, sicker, and the rates are quite high. So each COBRA premium is different depending on what the group losses are, what their experience is. So they're all over the map, but it could be very expensive for somebody. At the end of the COBRA period, you can get a continuation conversion policy. So you, at the end of the 18 months or whatever the time frame it is, you can switch to an individual policy. Those rates are the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association rates in Minnesota. Now, people do have options. If you have a spouse that's covered by another group policy, you could get covered there. There is, in Minnesota, individual products that you would be underwritten, meaning looking at you to see if you're insurable. If you're not insurable, we have the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, our high-risk health insurance pool that has good coverage, too. The other thing, and I would caution people about this one, but you can buy short-term health coverage in Minnesota. It's good for 1 year. It will not cover any pre-existing condition. So if you have any health problems, it will never, never, never cover it. So it's something we strongly encourage the public to be very, very cognizant of that aspect, that it's not going to cover an existing illness. We've seen, unfortunately, occasionally the horror stories where somebody didn't recognize what that meant and wind up with some big, huge medical bills and then find out it's not covered. But basically, COBRA is a wonderful benefit. It's going to let you continue your coverage, both individual or group, in Minnesota. It's key if you can afford it. And like I said, some policies are inexpensive, some are not. But for sure, it is a wonderful benefit, especially for somebody that has some health problems. And we've seen people make some extreme sacrifices to continue that policy just so they can maintain that continuous coverage, because they need that coverage to be maintained so they can pay for their medical bills. If you've got any questions, I'm more than happy to answer
those. Mr. Gross, do you have any sense of how many people actually use COBRA after they lose their job?
Madam Chairman, no, we have no idea. Sorry.
Data's not collected on that?
No. Madam Chair, the health insurance industry might know, but we do not know what percentage of people that have the opportunity to opt for COBRA don't pursue that.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, members.
Okay, next we have Lee Nelson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. I was asked to provide a little unemployment insurance basics. I do want to provide you with a number, and I'm going to correct my boss when he testified just a short time ago about the number of individuals requesting unemployment benefits in Minnesota. He mentioned the number 105,000. He was off by 50. It's 155,387 people requested unemployment benefits last week. That's 128,052 on regular state benefits and an additional 27,000 some on the current federal extension, which is in place. To put other things in perspective, 15,387,000 people applied for benefits last week in Minnesota, which also happens to be the busiest week of the year, given the quarter change and a few other things in the first of the year. They're always traditionally the busiest week of the year, but 15,387 applied for benefits last week. The unemployment insurance program in Minnesota covers 97% of all workers. The workers who aren't covered, the major exceptions, are self-employed people, independent contractors, and church workers. But there are 34 exceptions to coverage listed in the statute, including members of the legislature. All elected officials are not covered by the unemployment insurance program. And leave it at that. I do want to say, to qualify for unemployment insurance, Minnesota has some of the lowest thresholds in the nation. We haven't changed those thresholds in 25 or 30 years. We look at a four-calendar, a quarter period, called your base period. You need $1,000 in your high quarter and $250 in the remaining three quarters, and you will qualify for some unemployment benefits. You qualify, the lowest weekly benefit amount, quite frankly, is $38, which would be 50% of your average wage if you had a high quarter of $1,000. You were earning $76 a week, you would just qualify for $38. The maximum benefit entitlement currently in Minnesota, which is the sixth highest in the nation, is $566. To put it in perspective, the current maximum in Wisconsin is $355. And South Dakota less, and North Dakota less, and Iowa less than all of Wisconsin. And Minnesota is over $200 a week higher than the state of Wisconsin. Currently, the average person is entitled to what amounts to about 22 weeks of benefits. You figure out the length or the amount of total a person can collect based upon their past wages to a maximum of 26 times their weekly. So an individual essentially can collect up to 11 times. The minimum would be 11 times your weekly benefit amount up to a maximum of 26 times your weekly benefit amount. You really don't collect for weeks. You collect for a total amount of money over a one-year period. So you could collect partial benefits because, let's say, you're working part-time. So you collect partial benefits for up to a 52-week duration. You don't collect... 26 weeks is just kind of a misnomer because you don't get 26 weeks of benefits. You get an amount which you collect for a one-year period. And if you're collecting full benefits, you may run out in 26 weeks. But you may run out in 11 if that's all you're entitled to. It varies depending upon how much you previously worked. The average person currently collects about 19 weeks of benefits in Minnesota. Now that's risen. Back in 1999, it was under 12 weeks. So it's up to 19 weeks currently. As Representative Norton indicated, out of people who apply for benefits, 70% were laid off due to lack of work. 30% either quit or were fired. Most of those individuals who were fired are determined eligible for benefits. Two-thirds are found eligible, one-third are found ineligible. Out of people who quit, 90% are found ineligible. The current law provides for if you quit your job, you're ineligible, but there are 9 exceptions to that. So if you quit and fall under one of those 9 exceptions, then you are paid unemployment benefits. 45% of all people who are laid off due to lack of work are either temporarily or seasonally laid off. And that may be for a short period, it's a couple weeks, all the way up to a number of months. Benefit payments can be delayed. You can be laid off, but you're delayed benefits because you're receiving vacation pay, severance pay. You could be receiving workers' compensation. You could have weekly payments that are reduced because you're working part-time. You can collect unemployment benefits if you're working up to a certain amount, up to 32 hours. And so long as you don't earn more than your weekly unemployment benefit amounts, you can collect some partial benefits. You may also collect unemployment benefits while you're collecting Social Security. You may also receive it while you're collecting a pension. Or all of these is what makes it fairly complex. The unemployment insurance statute, the copy which I carry around with me, is 128 pages long. So it's a fairly complex program which has been in place since 1936. Eligibility for unemployment insurance is determined on a week-by-week basis. So you could be found eligible one week and ineligible the next week. Because maybe you didn't look for work that week. Maybe you weren't available for work. Maybe you went on vacation or something else. There may be any one of a number of reasons why you may be eligible one week and ineligible the next week. That's kind of unemployment insurance in 3 minutes. I normally do it in probably... I've done day-long seminars on it. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Nelson. For those of us who don't track this, it's really very, very interesting, especially now when it's so relevant for so many of our citizens in Minnesota. Are there questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, if I might explain to the committee, currently what I said, I didn't point out also, there's currently a federal extension in place of up to 33 weeks. Currently, an individual in Minnesota could collect up to, I'll call it a maximum of 59 times their weekly benefit amount. And we do expect an additional extension to come in place. It's a state extension, which is already in place in 268.115 of an additional 13 weeks. So we expect unemployment benefits to be available to Minnesotans up to a maximum of about 72 weeks. Benefits would become available fairly shortly.
Okay, we've got Representative Broad and then Representative Loss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just trying to understand the seasonal unemployment a little bit better. Can you talk a little bit about if you take a job, recognizing it's the potential of you being laid off during the winter, construction industries, things like that is rather high. Is there any, how does the unemployment benefit work for those folks who recognize it going in versus those who are laid off unwillingly in a different way?
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, Minnesota has no limitations on seasonal workers. There are a lot of state employees who collect unemployment benefits, work for the DNR, work for the Department of Revenue, who just work certain periods of time, work for cities, maybe work in the Parks Department, and don't work in the winter, maybe do snow plowing, and then don't work in the summer. Minnesota has no seasonality provisions limiting people who accept a job which only has limited duration.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Brad?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Lawson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nelson, you mentioned that eligibility is a week-by-week process that you have to monitor. Could you give us some background on, like, what percent go on and off during a normal period of unemployment? I mean, is it 90% are continuously unemployed and 10% bounce around? And then my second question would be, if you have any information or if you've ever surveyed people to determine what percent are uninsured for health care coverage, or how many switch to a spouse's coverage or have coverage in any other way?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'd have to go back and ask some of our people how many people slip on and off. But when you've got 155,000 at any one point in time, I have seen cases involving, tapers. They do come in and do some taping in your housing, sheetrock tapers. Literally work 1 week and then don't work the next, and they go on and off unemployment benefits literally weekly for a whole year. I mean, it's kind of a constant. They go in and out of the system. That's not unique. Now, how many come on once they come on? Most people who come in stay on and then return to employment and don't return. One third of everyone who applies for unemployment benefits applied last year. Over 20% file 5 years in a row. Give you a little bit of a perspective. But I'd have to go back and ask some of our statisticians to tell you how many people collected 1 week, didn't collect the next, but then collected the following week. I'd have to have that done. As to your question on how many people have health care coverage, the unemployment insurance program is funded, the administration is funded solely by a federal grant, and they restrict what we do. We literally can't do those kind of surveys with the federal funds, and they are very restrictive. So we're kind of limited. We gather only certain information. To the extent we try to gather more information, U.S. Department of Labor would say that's fine, but you're not going to do it with federal funds. So we've never done that. We have no idea how many individuals have health care coverage or had health care coverage in their employment. We simply don't ask that information. We do get complaints that our current application for benefits is too long, and I will give a plug that about 50% of the questions have nothing to do with unemployment insurance. They're gathered solely for statistical purposes, unrelated to unemployment insurance.
Right, members, I know
Representative Loeffler has a follow-up. I just want to let people know we have about 10 more minutes to spend on this bill, and we've got, after Representative Loeffler, we've got Abler, Root, and Bunn. And I just want to remind the committee that we're not voting on this today. We will have an opportunity again. I don't know if Mr. Nelson can come back, but, you know, I just want to make sure that we remember that the scope of this is just as it relates to Representative Thiessen's bill, although we could certainly learn a lot about unemployment here. Representative Loeffler, can you follow up briefly?
Madam Chair, I'll pass.
Thank you. Representative Abler.
I'll speak to the bill then, and I'll waive my... This is interesting about unemployment. I never sat through a hearing on that. So. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so just Representative Thiessen just commenting about the bill. I was just did some math based upon our last hour's discussion about the DHS budget, and I was curious, what does it cost per member per month for Minnesota Care? And this is an enhanced Minnesota Care product you've got. Of the 120,000 people in Minnesota Care, estimated from 2009, it's going to cost $540 million, according to their numbers, which is $375 per member per month, which is about what I thought it would be. And when I look at the $1,700 COBRA, like, wow, that's a ton of money. But five people at Minnesota Care, if they're paying the full rate, would be over $1,800. So it's we're in an expensive business. But I just wanted to commend you for trying to work on this. It's risky and scary to sit there at the table saying, well, here's my bill, what do you think? And people pile on with helpful thoughts. But it seems to me, I was just in the audience chatting with some of the mm-hmm. Mayan people, and you know, if it's the will of the body to reach out to unemployed persons and find some way to do some health care help, I think that's probably a commendable goal. How we go about that is a million-dollar question. But I have to think, and also just hearing about the pre-existing things from Mr. Gross, if the people lose their COBRA, they've lost their locked-in health care with all the pre-existing stuff that doesn't count against them. And so maybe there's some way we can just keep our heads on about this and find some way to subsidize the COBRA, which could be done maybe easier than normal or something. I think, you know, I thought of that as I was listening here. So, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Abler. And I don't think I mentioned, we have two more testifiers as well. So, Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is to Mr. Nelson, very specifically to the bill on Section C of the bill on line 1.23 in the version of the A1 amendment I have. It specifically asked the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development to collect information from individuals applying for unemployment insurance that would then be conveyed to the Commissioner of Human Services, and probably also related to the person at that time, whether some information about whether they might be eligible for this program. Could you comment on how difficult it might be to collect this information at this point, where you will be having contact from them, with them?
And Madam Chair, Representative, as I understand the bill, and I'll profess to know nothing about Minnesota Care, other than I read the bill very quickly this morning, is my extent of knowledge of Minnesota Care. Unemployment insurance, I know. Currently, the current law provides that the department can share any of the information with any other state agency if they need information we gather to administer their program in the Health and Human Services area. So we can currently provide any of the information we currently collect. And as I understand this bill, it's simply, is this person eligible to receive benefits? We would say yes. I mean, we could transfer that information. That would be really easy, and I can't imagine it would be very costly to provide them that information. We could do that on a weekly basis.
And Madam Chair, I mean, that's exactly the point and why the bill is drafted as it is, to avoid all the collecting the income information and all that stuff, because then that complicates things immensely, or to collect information about who your COBRA plan is through. I mean, that's kind of precisely the point.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And let's move on. And we've got two more testifiers, and I don't want to stop anybody from asking questions that you really feel you need to ask, but we need to move through this a little bit quickly. So, Patricia Brady. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representatives. I am Patricia Brady, and I am the Director of Workforce Solutions, which is the Employment and Training Department in Ramsey County. We are also the administrative entity for the Federal Workforce Investment Act program. Our department assists individuals who are low-income adults through the Workforce Investment Act. We also assist Minnesota Family Investment participants, youth, and dislocated workers through our Workforce Investment Act. The funding for my purpose here today really is to give you a little bit more information about what we're seeing on a day-to-day basis with what the unemployed workers that we are supporting are experiencing. The funding for the Dislocated Worker Program provides help with job search, career counseling, training, and supportive services. For example, we can help with mortgage, with rent, transportation, health care, clothing, personal counseling, and other emergencies. It should be noted, though, that all dislocated workers that are in our program are receiving services. However, there are a lot of unemployed people who are not in our program. They are unemployed, but they're not receiving any of the services that I've named. In the past year, we've witnessed an increase in the number of people coming into our St. Paul, our North St. Paul, and our down east side St. Paul Workforce Centers. There were 13,817 unduplicated individual visits in 2007 to our Workforce Centers, compared with 18,732 in 2008. This is a 26.5% increase, which shows the significant increase that we're seeing in people that are looking for employment. We have experienced an increase in our caseload also for the dislocated worker programs from 2007 to 2008. Currently, we have a two-month waiting list. There are so many people that are waiting to get these services, we are not able to get to them. The average length of time that an individual has been in the program is 54 weeks, and we are beginning to see an increase in the length of time that people are staying on the program. Our employment guidance counselors are seeing many more participants also who need health care coverage. Due to increased pressure around the lack of health care, we initiated a survey to get a better perspective on what our participants do and do not have with respect to health care insurance coverage. And I provided some handouts for you on this, and I'll talk through a few of them. The first one is a summary of the early results that we've been getting back from the survey. We sent out about 375 surveys to clients. We've received back 144, which is approximately about a 38% return. So the information that I'm providing is really based on that. The first thing to note, though, is that 81% of those who responded had health care coverage while they were employed. And 63% of those did not purchase coverage when they lost their employment. You can read in your handout number 2 some of the responses as to how much the others who did take COBRA are having to pay and what their experiences are. We have very many of their quotes listed there for you. Based upon our survey responses, single coverage for COBRA averages about $409 per month, and family coverage is about $1,058 per month. Coverage, of course, varies according to the quality, but a newly published report by the Families USA, which is also a handout that I believe that you have, shows that on average, Minnesotans are using about 24% of their unemployment check for single COBRA coverage, while families are using an average of about 70%. We have participants in our programs using 100% of their unemployment benefit check for health insurance because they happen to have illnesses and it's required for them to continue their health care coverage. The second point I'd like to note is in your handout number 1, and that is question number 6, asks how many respondents dropped their health care coverage after losing their employment, and you'll see that about 38.5% of them dropped coverage. And in handout number 3, there is a sampling of how long people have been without coverage and a handful of the reasons why they are without this coverage. The final point of my comments really pertains to the last question that we asked in the survey, which is, what do you think you can afford for group coverage? The fourth handout shows about 40% of the respondents indicate that they could pay less than $100 per month, and another 39% said they could pay between $100 and $300. In that handout, I'd like to also point out that there's a little bit of a typo in the last line in the first grouping, states that 22.2% could pay something over $4,300 a month. It's actually $300 a month. So, Madam Chair and committee members, we're very happy to support the efforts here to have this discussion to talk about what could be done to help the unemployed people that are in Minnesota with additional coverage. And we think that HF 42 is a really good start at that. We are happy to be available and part of any future discussions that you might have about addressing this issue. And thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brady, and I'd like to hold on any questions, if there are any right now, and let's get the last testifier in, and then, Ms. Brady, if you can just stick around for a few minutes in case there are any questions for you. The next testifier is Becky Weinhandel. Welcome to the committee. I hope I didn't mispronounce your name, but please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. And if you would, please try to keep it brief because we are a little bit over time. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Becky Weinhandel, private citizen. I prepared 3 to 5 minutes. I'll try to go quick or cut when possible. Excuse me. Again, my name is Becky Weinhandel. October 3rd was my last day as an EPIC system support specialist at Regions Hospital. Because of the current economic environment, Regions was forced to reduce the workforce, and I became an unfortunate statistic. In my last position at Regions, I worked to help physicians, nurses, and ancillary staff use EPIC, one of the most popular and robust electronic medical records available. Following my severance period, I was able to use COBRA for the month of November at the cost I paid as an employee, which was around $74. But beginning in December, I had to pay I had the option to pay a full price for COBRA. The full monthly price for me to continue my medical and dental benefits under COBRA would be $578.35. And this is for a single, reasonably healthy 30-something. Currently, my full income is unemployment insurance, which pays me $419 gross per week. In addition to being less than half of what I earn at Regions, to participate in COBRA would consume 34.5% of my current gross income. COBRA would be, for me, the percentage of income that is usually allocated for a person's largest expense, that being housing. Let's get down. As mentioned, October 3rd was my last day of work at Regions Hospital. In 2001, I was laid off from 3M, where I worked as an IT analyst. Following that layoff, I looked for similar work, but with the events of September 11th, I was not able to get a job of the same caliber. Eventually, I took the first office job that I could get. My primary reason for choosing underemployment over unemployment was medical insurance. Simply put, I was afraid to be uninsured at a time where my country's safety was unclear. It took about 5 years for me to get to the point where I had almost regained the income and job status that I had at 3M. And I was an EPIC system support specialist for about 2.5 years until I found myself laid off again. I'm college educated and alumna of the College of St. Catherine in St. Paul. I have a history of positive work reviews and often complimented on my smart perspectives and analytical mind. Yet twice in my short work life, I've been in this predicament. A predicament that, to me, on paper, shouldn't correlate. I've been laid off due to circumstances beyond my control, and I'm now without access to affordable health care. In the macro, this speaks to our outdated and, in my opinion, wrong-headed structure of employer-provided medical and dental insurance. In the micro, it speaks to my personal health insecurity. I'm aware of my lack, of health insurance every day. You may be able to tell that I have a bad cold. I cannot afford for my cold to develop into an ear infection or an upper respiratory infection. Luckily, to this point, I've been able to treat my symptoms with over-the-counter meds and old-fashioned remedies. Recently, I was climbing an 8-foot ladder to put some items in the attic. I distinctly remember standing at the top of that ladder and reminding myself that I don't have insurance. I better not fall. Excuse me. While traveling, I also remind myself to watch for icy spots because I can't afford to fall and hurt something beyond a sprain or a strain. For some, a fall would be an inconvenience. For me, it could be financially ruinous. In addition, I also do have a unique perspective for a person of my age. While I am relatively healthy, I have two aging pets, a dog with diabetes and multiple orthopedic ailments, and a cat with diabetes. And while these situations would not be remedied by this legislation, I realize that. I want to relay that the deep understanding that I have of the ongoing cost of treating chronic health conditions, and because of the cost of prescriptions, insulin, syringes, and testing supplies, I've had to shop around their prescriptions looking for the lowest price. Ultimately, me, my little family of pets, we joined the Walgreens Prescription Savings Club. And while I was insured, I didn't use this option, but since layoff, I must use this option. Recently, I sold a 3-month supply of a medication that would retail for over $300. But as a member of the Walgreens Prescription Savings Club, I only had to pay $171. I realize the state of Minnesota is in a budget dilemma. Something that we in Minnesota are proud of is our quality of life and a reputation for good government. Mm-hmm. As one with a lifetime view from the middle class, I've had very little interaction with my government. I've never needed to apply for any type of assistance other than government-guaranteed student loans and unemployment insurance. And I've never lobbied for tax subsidies or stadiums. I've worked since I was 16 years old and would prefer to be working now rather than being here. People like me, people who play by the rules and work hard, are now in need of help. Please, don't just pass, but expedite House Bill 42 for people like me all over Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate your coming here today and speaking in spite of your obvious difficulty in doing so. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Either of the last two testifiers, Representative Broad.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you very much. While you point out a significant problem and are supportive of the bill, I think a couple things that you mentioned are worth repeating. One thing that you talked about was shopping around in getting a better deal.
Right.
That's something that we should be doing in healthcare, and I applaud you for doing it for your pets. We ought to have a system where you're allowed to do it for yourself and encouraged to do it for yourself because it's something that affects your bottom line. So I do appreciate that. The other thing that you mentioned that I wanted to repeat was just I think you used the words outdated system. And what you meant was essentially the employer-based system. And I think what this bill points out to me is that while this is one solution, I would look at the solution a little bit differently, but I think the solution, or what it points out to me, is that we've got to start delinking from something that ties people to one job. And when we look at how long people stay in jobs, we look at the economic situation, it just seems to me that healthcare ought to be portable, it ought to move with you, it ought to be yours, and it ought to be something that you control in terms of the dollars and how you spend it. And while we disagree on the approach, I think there is agreement around the issue on delinking some things from the employer-based system. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Representative Broad. Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. That was very heartfelt, and I'm sorry that you're sick, but thanks for being here. I'm curious, have you tried to look for private health insurance after, are you still on COBRA? I think you did that for 1 month.
I did it for 1 month.
And have you looked for private, and if so, what did you find out if you did?
I did not look for private insurance. Based on anecdotes from others that I'd spoken to, I didn't think it would be a viable option. I figured if COBRA wasn't affordable, finding my own policy wouldn't be affordable as well. Or if it would be affordable, it would be the catastrophic, which people who are my age tend to forego.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there another question from the committee? Representative Thiessen, do you have some closing comments?
Well, just briefly, thank you, members, for taking the time to think about this issue. And, obviously there's details and approaches that we have to work through here. But I think we got to keep in mind here that healthcare is only one piece of this unemployment picture. I mean, people are basically, as we heard the testimony, you're limited to half your previous income, you know, and with that you have to pay your mortgage, you have to pay for food, you have to pay for gas, and then you have to pay for health care, which can add up to, as we heard here, 25% on average for a single person, 75% of the benefit, or 70% of the benefit on average for a family. That, I don't think, is acceptable, and we need to, that's why I think it's urgent that we address this issue in this context. I do want to note one other thing, and that's that this legislation is drafted as a one-time piece for this current economic crisis that sunsets in 2 years. And so I think it's actually a very appropriate use of one-time money, which we have in the Health Care Access Fund as well, to let us get through this economic crisis and shield the thousands of families that are going through this and the thousands more that than usual that go through this issue of unemployment. And so what I would encourage is people have other ideas. If they have an idea about how to do this through the private sector, you know, let me know. I'd be happy to talk about it. But I think the most fundamental thing we keep in mind is we don't make this bureaucratic. We make it as simple as possible so that we can get the relief to people as quickly as possible. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Peach. Do you have a motion? Did you want to move to lay this?
Oh, yeah. I would move that we lay House File 42 on the table.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Peason moves to lay House File 42 on the table. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you.
Okay, members, for the last 20 minutes here, we're going to start on a process of talking about how the Department of Human Services approaches the job that they have and what they see as their core mission and their priorities, and how they measure whether they're living up to those priorities and missions. So welcome to the committee. Sorry to keep you waiting so long. I don't know who wants to go first, Mr. Bartay or Ms.
We were waiting for the system to warm up here,
okay.
But let's just get started in the interest of time. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jen Augustin, and with me is Steve Bartay. We work in DHS's Office of Management and Budget. We're going to provide an overview of three topics today, as the chair indicated. First, DHS's mission and strategic priorities. Second, the high-level goals and performance data that are found on the administration's Accountability Minnesota site. And third, our efforts to measure performance of the human services delivery system on a county-by-county basis. You should have a packet in front of you that has some supporting materials, and we've also provided some links where you can find additional information. One note I'll make as we get started. Our goal is to give you just a high-level overview of this information, but you'll continue to hear DHS managers and staff talk about these topics as we go through the legislative session, and we'd also be happy to follow up with any specific information requests that you have. All right. So starting on the second page of the packet, the mission of the Department of Human Services is to help people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. We strive to focus on people, not programs. We provide ladders up and safety nets for the people. Ladders up and safety nets for the people we serve. We work in partnership with many others, including the legislature, to accomplish the mission. And we're accountable for results, first to the people we serve and ultimately to all Minnesotans. And I'll note that this is a department that's full of employees who are mission-driven and really care about doing better for the Minnesotans that we serve. The department has established six priorities to provide direction to our work and guide our planning efforts. These priorities are a tool for operationalizing and prioritizing the responsibilities that are given to the department by the legislature. They're redefined every 2 years to incorporate new or different responsibilities that you have passed into law. Your packet has a one-page summary of each of these six priorities. including the vision, key strategies, and outcome measures for each. I'll highlight just a few things on each of them as we go through. On page 3 is the at-risk adult summary. This priority focuses on adults without children who are or are likely to become homeless, who are in danger of entering or re-entering the correctional system, or who have chronic mental health or chemical dependency difficulties. They are people who may not meet certain thresholds for our services or who tap into some but not all of the services they need. They often face difficulties navigating our human services system. Last year, we brought together people from across the department and other state agencies to discuss how to improve the current system so that it functions effectively for at-risk adults. The team developed recommendations for cultural competence, outreach, assessment, eligibility, and service delivery. They received feedback from a variety of external stakeholders, including communities of color, tribes, counties, and nonprofit organizations. We now have a common vision for a more integrated service delivery system that will guide our actions to improve services and outcomes for these adults. You'll notice that each of these priorities has a set of outcome measures that we are tracking. They're on the bottom of page 3, and you'll see that section on your screen. Moving to page 4, our second priority relates to at-risk
children. Representative Laughlin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Augustin. I applaud your efforts towards moving towards this, and I know it's an initial effort, but in the handout on the priority at risk adults, it didn't reflect some of the values that you actually introduced us with, although your comments did. And so I just think as you're working this through, you need to have that reflected, because I was struck when I read it was create an internal working group that will develop program options across a whole range of services that are primarily delivered by nonprofits and counties and others outside of DHS. Mm-hmm. And I thought, why are we doing this internally and not involving everyone? And then it sounded like you did that internally, but you sought feedback afterwards. You had put together a plan. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think, you know, as you're using these tools to communicate to others, I think it's helpful to show that kind of partnership value. But I'm most concerned about the state government-specific measures, and I'm hoping that as this evolves, it'll actually go to focusing on people rather than programs. And on this one, the measure is the number of housing opportunities developed, which is basically a construction measure. It's nothing about, you know, lives transformed, stability, you know, the kinds of follow-up about whether, you know, we made a difference by integrating the service system or implementing the model that you talk about developing. And so that I hope that as you're working through this, in the future, we're going to start to see measures that actually show the people impact, and that really reflect a more integrated process. Because when I first read this, my impression was it was all being done internally, and it wasn't really looking at the bigger service system, which is a lot of it is funded by charitable donations and property taxes. It's not just state investments.
Mr.
Chair, thank you. I appreciate that feedback, and this effort started internally with some discussion among ourselves about how we need to coordinate better within the department, and there was quite a bit of external participation during the development of those recommendations. We need to reflect that.
Representative Hayden also had a question, but if you're still answering the earlier
That's
question.
Fine, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at Representative Lawler's question about the number of new supportive housing opportunities, and I wonder, your department doesn't build supportive housing. You support the services that go into supportive housing. Is that right?
That's correct. We are working in partnership with Minnesota Housing on the business plan to end long-term homelessness.
Okay, so there are some measurements that, I mean, I'm not going to ask you for those now, but there are some outcomes that you would have in terms of people's lives based on the service and support that you've given,
yes.
The supportive housing that's been developed. Would that be right?
We'd be happy to provide you with that information.
Okay.
Thank you. And members, I think with the time we have left, why don't we try to get through as much as possible? We're going to come back to this. I think this document and kind of the idea of looking at some of these outcomes including some of the person-centered outcomes that Representative Loffler was referring to, will guide a lot of our work as we go through here this year. So why don't we just let the department just kind of present today, and then if you have questions, we can get into it later. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Page 4 of your packet addresses the at-risk children priority. This priority focuses on children who have experienced abuse or neglect, deep poverty, homelessness, chemical dependency, mental illness, and criminal justice involvement. These are children at risk for poor outcomes. They have multiple needs that cross multiple service areas, and they need to be served in a coordinated, integrated manner. We are focusing on continuous improvements in the child welfare system and on improving early intervention, service integration, and more culturally competent services. We depend on many partners to assist us in moving towards positive outcomes for SD children. Our third priority, page 5, is about reducing disparities in service access and outcomes. Although Minnesota often performs well in human services measures compared to other states, not all populations experience the same outcomes. A disproportionate number of racial and ethnic populations are served by our programs, and their outcomes often fall below the majority population. As you can see on the bottom of page 5, there are a number of performance measures we're tracking by race and ethnicity, and we're currently expanding our efforts to ensure that every program area is collecting and reviewing racial and ethnic data on key measures to better understand disparities. Meanwhile, there are strategies in place across the department to reduce disparities and increase the capacity of the human services system to provide appropriate services for everyone. We're piloting new methods and sharing best practices. Reducing disparities is a fundamental responsibility and integral to our work and must be done in dialogue and in partnership with many others. Our fourth priority on page 6 is our healthcare priority. The goal is to use the state's participation in the healthcare market to improve healthcare quality, access, and outcomes and affordability for all Minnesotans. We are pursuing pay-for-performance models that focus on quality and provide incentives for better outcomes. We are pursuing clinical care coordination for clients with multiple complex illnesses. We've made managed care products available to seniors and people with disabilities to improve coordination and integration of services. We're part of a public-private collaborative to improve the secure exchange of information among health providers. There are a number of other strategies underway at DHS and other efforts that have been championed by the legislature with widespread agreement that reform is needed. Our fifth priority relates to chemical and mental health. Addiction and mental illness have broad impacts on individuals, their families, and the systems trying to help them. There is a relationship between this priority and all of the other priorities. Consistent with the healthcare priority, we have made targeted effort at improving quality, access, and outcomes for mental health and chemical dependency treatment. In recent sessions, the governor proposed and the legislature authorized significant investments in the mental health system. We now have a common benefit set across all Minnesota healthcare programs. We're implementing models for integrating the delivery of mental and physical health care, and we've made targeted investments in the infrastructure. We've also made great strides in training providers on the use of evidence-based practices to improve outcomes for adults and children with mental illness. For chemical dependency treatment, we are also now publishing outcome measurement data by provider to inform the delivery of services. Our final priority, I feel like this has been a whirlwind tour of the Department of Human Services. Final priority is improving home and community-based services for elderly and people with disabilities by establishing and using performance measures and standards. This is an area in which we expect to see a 70% increase in the number of people needing services over the next 20 years. So it's critical that we focus on the effectiveness of these services. In a multi-year effort working with our stakeholders, we will be developing performance measures and a report card for providers of home and community-based services. Many of you are probably familiar with the report card that's been developed for nursing homes. It will parallel that effort.
This will help consumers make informed choices about services and ensure that services are appropriate and effective to meeting their needs. We will now turn to addressing our performance measurement efforts.
Go ahead. With the county, were you going to say?
Yeah.
I think in light of the time, why don't we come back, because I think that's a whole other subject that we need to talk about differently. Members, and I apologize that we didn't have more time to dig into this document more in the hearing today. But I think the value of this document and the work that the department has done is kind of set us, at least give us a framework for thinking about our health and human services system in a way that's not just about budgets, but more about kind of what we're trying to accomplish. And that's the direction I'd like our committee to think about as we move through this very difficult budget. And in the Finance Committee, we're going to be spending a lot of time on budgets and having to prioritize a lot of things in terms of cuts. And so I thought one thing that could parallel in the Policy Committee is to do a little more thinking, not just about dollars and cents, but about what those priorities ought to be and what the, you know, we're probably not even going to be able to fulfill all these objectives after this budget is done. So to think about, is this the right set of objectives? Is this the right focus for us? And it's yes or no. And if it is, what's the most important priorities and how do we deliver those services? So what I'd like is for members to spend time looking at this, make email Kate some questions you have or some different ideas about it, and then we can have the department come back, get the questions to them before they come back so they can kind of direct their testimony a little more specifically. Anyway, I apologize for it making you wait, but thank you for the start on this. I appreciate it. And then any comments or announcements or anything from members? All right. Otherwise, we'll adjourn. Thank you. Oh, and the network, obviously not tomorrow, but Thursday. And we're going to talk about nursing homes and some of the incidents that happened in Albert Lea and Montevideo and that kind of thing. Thank you.